What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning is Molly Antipol, the author of a new book of short stories called The Un-Americans. We'll also have a visit from our Too Jewish expert on the international scene, Tom Price, and our Mevina on Israel, Oshrat Borel. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. I expected here on Too Jewish today to be able to begin to reflect on an outstanding Israel experience I've just had, one of the very best of my 15 trips to Israel, and perhaps begin to talk about my wife Wendy's and my week-long trip to Spain, seeing some of the important Jewish sites in that remarkable country. But things happen in this world that change our plans. I returned from Israel last Monday night, boarding a plane before the fate of the three Israeli teenage boys kidnapped at the Gush Etzion intersection was known. It was the day we landed in Israel that Eyal Yifrach, Gilad Shar, and Naftali Frankel were kidnapped, and it was when I landed in Los Angeles that I heard of their bodies being found. I can tell you that the overwhelming focus of every news story and nearly every conversation we overheard during our extraordinary Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage trip to Israel was on the three teenage boys, yeshiva students, trying to get home early for the Sabbath from their schools. Everyone in the entire country, secular and religious alike, was focused on their fate. Every Israeli adult knew the potential pain of losing a child. Every young person could relate to the danger in an immediate and personal way. The whole nation responded as though family members were missing, as indeed they were. These three were not soldiers nor combatants. They were teenagers studying at respected yeshivot, two of them students of the great Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, who wrote, "We cannot just light a candle and say a prayer. It is up to us now to live our lives al Kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God through our deeds and our lives." As usual, Rabbi Steinsaltz, a past guest of Too Jewish, was right. We expect Israel to seek justice for their murderers and to respond to this horrific outrage. We must unflinchingly support Israel's right to do so. But we also know that those who wish to destroy must not be allowed to triumph, that eternal hatred is not the path that God wants or that the Torah teaches. We must remember that innocent lives taken in this way are not redeemed through blood. May the families of these boys find comfort in God, who alone can bring consolation at such times. May they feel the solidarity of Am Yisrael, the entire Jewish people who mourns with them. We pray that this will be the last time that such a horror is perpetrated. We, as the people of Israel, have suffered the pain and loss of three innocent young Jews, Eyal, Gilad, and Naftali. At this moment, we must ask God to give us the courage and fortitude to seek justice and the great wisdom to refuse to take vengeance. As tension continues to build, as rocket attacks are followed by bombing, as harsh rhetoric is accompanied by stone-throwing and arrests, we must continue to support Israel's need to seek justice, but we must also resist all calls for vengeance. The Torah's injunction obligating an eye for an eye is about compensatory justice, not revenge. God is the only one who is permitted to take revenge in Jewish tradition. Li nakam, Deuteronomy 32 quotes God as saying, "Vengeance is mine alone, not yours." It is essential that Israel responds strongly and seeks firmly to bring the perpetrators to the bar of justice. But it is just as important that we not give in to the natural feelings of anger and encourage or support acts of violent revenge. There is such a thing as a cycle of violence, and it surely is prevalent throughout the Middle East. these three horrific murders must not be allowed to create another round of it. May the memory of these three murdered teens be allowed to be a blessing, and encourage all of us to insist that such acts never occur again. One more note on the funeral for the three teens. Our own Temple Emmanuel pilgrimage group was in Modin a week before, visiting a vibrant Reform congregation, Yozma, and celebrating Havdalah with their preschool kids. The contrast between the vital energy of a dynamic young congregation and city and the burial of teenagers in the same town is stark. Yet both reflect the reality of Israel today, the incredible positive energy and amazing accomplishments of the only Jewish state in the world, and the awful challenge of those who hate it and wish to destroy it by any means, no matter how wildly immoral. In spite of the anxiety over the teens while we were there, we had an amazing experience in Israel on our pilgrimage, and I will reflect on it over the next few weeks. But you know, this morning, I'd like to focus a little on my own Jewish experiences in Spain last week. The golden age of Jewish life in Spain produced some of the greatest works of prayer, poetry, law, philosophy, and mysticism that the Jewish world has ever seen. As a longtime student and teacher of the philosophical and poetic works of Judah Halevi, and of the legal and philosophical genius of Moses Maimonides, and as the teacher of the longest-running Zohar study group in America using Danny Matt's translation of Moses de Leon's seminal mystical text, I have a personal and very rabbinic interest in Spain and Spanish Jewry. Of course, the golden age of Jewish life in Spain goes back a long time, roughly from the 9th century to, the 13th, 14th, or maybe even 15th century. All Jews were officially expelled from Spain in the year 1492 by King Ferdinand and Queen Isabella of Columbus fame. Still, I have always heard a great deal about the Sephardic sites in Spain, the wonderful places to visit, and was eager to see where Maimonides wrote, where Yehuda Halevi lived, to see the country where Jews had been generals and high courtiers, as well as poets, rabbis, biblical commentators, and philosophers. I am also a lover of Sephardic music and have sung and listened to these lovely and interesting compositions for many years. And so to play us in this morning, here's a composition from an album I picked up at the Synagogue and Jewish Museum in Toledo, Spain last week. It's a setting of the Zmirah for Shabbat, a Sabbath table song, Ki Eshmerah Shabbat, written by the great Sephardic poet and Torah commentator Abraham Ibn Ezra, with a melody by the Jews of Andalusia, Spain.
Ki Eshmerah Shabbat, El Shmereni, Oti Le'ol Me'ad, Beino Ubeini. Ki Eshmerah Shabbat, חפץ עשות דרכים קמי לדבר בו דברי צרכים דברי סחור אף דברי מלאכים הגה בתורת אל לא תחק מני כי יש מרשבת אין שמרני הנה לדור ראשון נתן קדושי מופת בטת להם משנה ושישי ככה בכל שישי יכפיל מזוני כי יש בהשבת איש מרני אותי לעולמי Thank you.
האל החוק לסגנוניו. בולה רוח לכם הפנים לפניו, הלכן להתענות על פי נבוניו. אסור לבד מיום כיפור אבוני, כי יש מרח שבת אין לי שמרני, עודי לעולמי
That was Kiyesh Mara Shabbat, a Spanish-Jewish text set to a Spanish-Jewish Sephardic melody. With all my anticipation, I was really excited to go to Spain, finally. I've traveled a lot, but somehow missed Spain before this, except for a day or two in Barcelona last year, and I really was looking forward not only to the country and its culture and food and art, but also to experiencing its Jewish heritage. I can tell you now that Spain is indeed a beautiful country. We were blessed with great weather, not the intense heat we were promised, which made the experience that much better. The food in Spain is delicious, the people warm and funny, and the art, monuments, and museums are incredible, as good as any in the world. We enjoyed the big city quality of Madrid, the beautiful antiquity of Toledo and Cordoba, the lovely gardens and courtyards everywhere, and we had a fabulous time in the lush city of Seville. It was all quite magical. And while we were warned that any country that has a very popular chain of tapas bars called Museo de Jamón, the Museum of Ham, would make it hard to find food we could eat as Jews, we found plenty in Spain and of great variety and high quality. You know, you have not fully lived until you have eaten excellent churros dipped in dark, thick, hot chocolate at the best place in Madrid. Actually, you might not live very long if you eat them often, but they are delicious, and so are many excellent tapas places throughout the country. I can also tell you, however, that the Jewish life and its important sites that we were so eager to see are mostly relics of a long-destroyed, if very deep, culture and community. While the synagogue in Toledo, now a museum, is the largest and most beautiful medieval temple I have ever seen, and there are many signs that Jews used to live in Spain and were a central part of the culture, the expulsion and the endless obsession of the Spanish Inquisition expunged Jewish life and vitality nearly completely. It is interesting to stay in the beautiful ancient Juderia of Sevilla, or wander through the Juderias in Cordoba or Toledo, named after the Jews, the Jewish quarter, but it is also pretty clear that there isn't much of a contemporary Jewish life there now. We did manage to attend an excellent and fascinating concert of Sephardic and flamenco music and dance at the Teatro Español in Madrid, featuring the wonderful Sephardic Israeli singer Yasmin Levy and the flamenco singer Mancha Cortez. But, having come to Spain directly from Israel, where Jewish life is unbelievably vital and vibrant, seeing Maimonides' statue does not compare to hearing living Jews debate his importance or actively study and critique his texts. Finding a street sign for Yehuda Halevi Square, mostly hidden by a green tree, does not measure up to the current debate about whether his passion for Zion is being misappropriated by the settler movement. Seeing the walls of León, where the Zohar was created by Moses de León, doesn't stack up with exploring its literary, mystical, and sensual beauty with real live Jews each week back home in Tucson. I guess I'm spoiled a little by living in the golden age of American Judaism and by having the opportunity to travel often to the rebuilt and rebuilding Zion of Israel and Jerusalem. Spain is wonderful, just not so much for its Jewish present. Well, it's the end of the 4th of July weekend back home here in America, and our guest has written a fine exploration of what it means to become an American. Her book is called The Un-Americans, an excellent new collection of short stories, and we'll talk with Molly Antipol about what it means to be an un-American in America when we return on Too Jewish in a few moments.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU. Dream it. Do it. Visit asu.edu.
Parents in Tucson have many choices on where to send their children to school. Consider the best. Consider Tucson Hebrew Academy. Now is the time to secure your spot for the upcoming school year. With a beautiful Foothills K-8 campus and award-winning academics, you owe it to your children to visit THA, Tucson Hebrew Academy, and see what they have to offer. Your child belongs at THA. THA delivers. Low student-teacher ratio supports successful, rigorous academics, and they don't stop there. With an emphasis on the arts, science, and music, THA students learn the Hebrew language and are taught Jewish values along with a rigorous academic curriculum. Your child deserves the best. Call 529-3888 to schedule your tour of THA. Financial aid is available. Don't wait. Space is limited. That's 529-3888 or visit www.thaaz.org. We are delighted to welcome to Do Jewish our guest this morning, author Molly Antipol. Her book is called The Un-Americans. It's a wonderful group of short stories. It has received a great deal of not only praise, but wild acclaim, I would say. Molly Antipol teaches writing at Stanford. She was a recent Wallace Stegner Fellow. Her writing has appeared in a variety of famous magazines and appropriate writing magazines, but this is her first book. Good morning and welcome.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
So tell us a little bit about the origin of The Un-Americans and what prompted you to write, first of all, a collection of short stories instead of, oh, say, a novel.
Well, you know, I've always loved short stories. I think, you know, ever since I was a kid, that was just the form that I was really drawn to. And I come from such a big family of storytellers that I think it just was sort of like in my blood. And a lot of the stories in the book were inspired by my family history, notably, you know, their involvement in the Communist Party. And so those early stories of hearing about my, you know, my mom and my grandparents, you know, living with tap lines and the FBI sorting through their trash and just like that level of surveillance was really what got me going on the first stories.
Do you think all Jews are good storytellers? Is it something in our blood?
You know, I don't know if there's a really right answer to that, but I will say that most of the Jews I know are really good storytellers. And it's funny. I have a good friend who's from Louisiana, and we were talking about how he says we have front porch stories and you have stoop stories, and I think that is kind of true. It's that act of just like sitting down and just having a full story in your mind before you even start.
You know, do you, when you start a short story, have the whole concept together, or does it kind of write itself sometimes?
It writes itself. I find that whenever I have the entire concept together, those stories usually kind of burn out and die. I think because there isn't enough for me to wonder about when I'm writing. And it's more, you know, if I just have a character or a situation and the character starts to feel real to me, that's when the story works, because I feel like this person is real and I'm just kind of following them no matter what they want to do.
When you started this collection, did you have it sort of organized chronologically? Did you think about it as a collection? Were these stories you'd written for magazines?
Yeah, that's such a good question, because it's such a different thing to write stories for magazines and for journals as opposed to putting them together in a book. So I could feel that each story was working well on its own when publishing them separately. But when I was putting together a book, it was almost like I started to think about it in the way that someone might put together an album, where I thought, okay, you know, I want to open up with something engaging, and then if I have a few moody stories, it's probably a good idea to have that kind of poppier, cheerier one, and then I'll end with a ballad. And that was really the way that I put together my book.
We will talk much more with Molly Antipol. Her book is called The Un-Americans. It's a wonderful collection of short stories, and we'll hear more about them when we come back on Too Jewish.
When you're looking to buy or sell your home, you probably want Tucson's best realtor on your side. That realtor is Jill Rich. As real estate values change, it's comforting to know that Jill Rich knows Tucson's real estate landscape. She follows the trends. She knows the neighborhoods. She even knows how to help you find financing. But most importantly, Jill cares. It doesn't matter if you're looking for a starter home or a castle. It's like having your bubby in the realty business. For sellers, Jill will develop a personal marketing program that'll sell your house fast. There's no one who knows Tucson real estate better. You can reach Jill Rich at Long Realty's River and Campbell office. Call 349-0174. Jill Rich, providing strong representation in a caring way. Call 349-0174.
Among my most pleasant, at least time-consuming duties, I have the honor of serving as president of the Kohan Memorial Foundation, which celebrates the memories of Rabbi Samuel S. and A. Irma Kohan, my own grandparents. Once a year, the foundation gives a substantial cash award to an individual for outstanding service to Klal Yisrael, the totality of the Jewish people. This service can involve any one of four different fields: unity, education and information, creative arts, or rescue. If you know of anyone who might qualify for the 2013 Kohan Award, just visit our website, www.kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N, and you'll find the nomination form to submit. And while you're there, you can also learn just who my own grandparents were and who participates in honoring their memory today. That's kohanaward.com, C-O-H-O-N-A-W-A-R-D. It's a good visit. We welcome David and Pam of Freedom Smoke. Tell us about your product, Freedom Smoke.
Hello, Rabbi Kohan. A pleasure to be here again. Electronic cigarette industry has been around for years. Our product, one of the best things that we've done to improve it, is the base ingredients for our product are brought in from outside of this country. The only place in the world is certified kosher.
Kosher, smokeless, no tobacco, and a variety of health advantages. Do you have a lot of former smokers that have kind of quit because of Freedom Smoke?
Absolutely. We have several people who have written to us as well as told us on a personal basis.
How many flavors are there of what you sell?
Over 700.
And when people walk in the store and they don't know what to do, what do you tell them?
We start them off by finding out what they smoke and how much they smoke. We then set them up with the nicotine level that's appropriate for them, and we find the correct flavor, and that's all that it takes.
How do people find your stores?
They can find us on the internet, of course, freedomsmokeusa.com. We have a toll-free number, 800-705-7013. Word of mouth is really good for our company, bringing people into our stores.
And it's kosher.
That's correct. Yep.
We'll talk next week.
Thank you.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, kvetch or kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail.com. Or visit our website, twojewishradio.com. You can hear all past and present shows through our website by streaming them or download us from the Apple iTunes Store's very popular Jewish podcasts. We are now pleased and serene to welcome back a recurring feature of Two Jewish, Two Haikus for Jews from Zen Judaism. No egg and no cream, just syrup, seltzer, and milk. The Zen of the egg cream. And, like a bonsai tree, your terrible posture at my dinner table. Those were two haikus for Jews, koans of Zen Judaism. We welcome our Mivi Nan Israel Oshrat Barel, head of the Weintraub Israel Center. Boker Tov, Oshrat.
Boker Tov, Rabbi. How are you?
I'm good. So Chag Sameach for us in America. It's 4th of July weekend, a couple of days after the Independence Day. Let's talk a little bit about how important the relationship between Israel and America is, something that we take for granted, but is actually an amazing alliance. From an Israeli perspective, now having lived in America for a year, talk a little bit about what you see.
I think from the period of time that I'm here, there is two main insights. There's more. But
of course.
First, that how important that we have like a Jewish communities here, strong Jewish community. And if at the past I thought everyone needs to come, every Jew needs to come to Israel and to live in Israel, I think it's good that we have strong communities here to support us and to make sure that, you know, the right decision will be made here. The second is how important is the connection that we have between, you know, these two governance, I would say, to first the people, the respect that we have between the Israelis and Americans, but also the connection and the collaboration that we have between the two nations, I would say, states.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, countries. yeah, and I really, really hope that no one and nothing will jeopardize this great connection.
You know, speaking as an American, I've seen that relationship, which has been strong for a long time, get only stronger over the years, in spite of whenever there are conflicts on political mm-hmm. issues.
Or Pollard issue or other stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Not sometimes even economic issues, but usually intelligence issues, lots of questions come up between even the closest allies.
I don't know if you saw, but a few weeks ago, I saw that Israel listed as the third country
third closest ally of the United States after England and Canada or something. I saw that.
Okay.
pretty close relationship. Yeah. Pretty supportive.
I thought we are the first, but you know.
We always think we're the first. We're Jews. Of course we think we're the first. Yeah. I do want to say something. You know, I think Israel treats this relationship with a great level of respect, which is one reason the alliance has continued to grow and build. Mm-hmm. And they've understood, whether it's everybody in Israel or just at the high levels of government, that there's no real percentage in getting into deep conflicts. There are sometimes political differences. Sometimes even presidents and prime ministers don't like each other, like now. And yet they still find a way to work closely together. So that's something important.
I think it's like in a family, like, I don't know if it's marriage, but more mechutan, mechutenet, even if you don't like it. Yeah, the in-laws, but
They may not love each other.
They understand that the family, the bond is more, it's much more important than the, you know, the people that right now are the main actors. I think that's what everyone have in mind, that the relationship will last I hope forever and
as we say, God willing.
Ken.
Oshra, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
Toda rabba, rabbi.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll hear from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, and get the old Jewish joke of the week.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
We are delighted to welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
We've been talking about wine and wine all around the Jewish world over the last few weeks. The one place we haven't talked about is Israel. Israel, of course, in ancient times had quite a wine industry, as did everywhere in the Mediterranean. And there's all kinds of information about the growing of grapes and when you first offer the produce of the fields and so on, way back into the early parts of the Torah. But there was no real wine industry under the Ottoman Empire, for fairly obvious reasons, a Muslim-controlled area, until Baron Rothschild imported a French wine industry of sorts to Zichron Yaakov in the north of Israel. Nowadays, Israeli wines are widely respected and growing in quality and certainly in quantity.
And probably overpriced.
And undoubtedly overpriced because, you know, it's an Israeli wine. If you're Jewish, you want a kosher wine.
Well, actually, in Israel, the Ministry of Finance recently raised taxes on all alcoholic goods. So drinks of any kind, including domestically produced wine, are hugely taxed in addition to what was already a fairly high price. I mean, kind of a standard bottle of decent Israeli wine is at least $20 off the shelf of a grocery store in Israel. And in a restaurant, it's, you know, $50 or $60. And up. That's the basic. So wine is probably twice as expensive in Israel as it is in the U.S., generally speaking, if not more. Some of it is good. All of it is getting better. There are boutique wineries in the valley of Elah, where David met Goliath, in the Golan Heights.
Some
pockets all over the countries, actually.
Right. The Judean
Hills.
All over
the
Galilee and the Judean Hills, right?
Right.
There's even some Negev wineries now, which is a little hard to believe.
Well, we have wineries in Arizona.
Yes, we do.
You know, and some of them produce quite decent wines, I must say.
Also true.
So depending on the altitude and the temperature and the amount of moisture, even largely desert soils can produce good wines. I mean, there are those who say that grapes which grow in very poor soil, in like rocky, flinty, dry, nutrient deficient soil, have to struggle to survive. And the grapes that struggle the hardest produce the best wine ultimately.
Fascinating. You could see the parallel that, like the Jewish people, which had to struggle for 2,000 years, we now produce all these Nobel Prize winners. So it should be the same with wine. Israeli wines, when I first went there when I was 15 years old and working at a youth village near Zichron Yaakov, were pretty horrible. Nowadays, there's not only excellent whites, which they got there first, but there's also some really good reds. You don't have to go to Israel to find them. And there's both kosher and non-kosher wines produced in Israel, which
right.
is interesting.
Very interesting, because one would think that the export market would largely be for kosher wines, but the domestic market includes a lot of people who couldn't care one way or another whether right. the wine is kosher. So, yeah, there's a huge improvement even over the past decade, never mind since you were 15, with all due respect.
Thank you very much. And what was I doing drinking wine at 15 anyway?
Very good question. I think maybe we ought to wrap up this session at that point.
I see. It was just Shabbos kiddish. Tom, thanks very much. We'll talk next week.
I look forward to it.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week, Jewish humor your Bubby and Zadie knew, brought to you by Too Jewish as a Public Service. Bernstein has retired to Florida. He's resting peacefully on the porch of his small facility outside of Miami when he sees a cloud of dust come up the road. He walks out to see who is approaching. It's a southern farmer with a wagon. "Good afternoon," says Bernstein.
"Afternoon," says the farmer.
"Where are you headed?" asks Bernstein.
"Town."
"What do you have in the wagon?" asks Bernstein.
"Manure,"
says the farmer.
"Manure, eh? Ha! Huh. What do you do with it?" asks Bernstein.
Spread it over the strawberries," says the southern farmer.
"Well," says Bernstein, "you should come over here for lunch. Here we use sour cream."
That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature to Jewish just for you. You should live and be well, and hopefully your accents will be better than mine was just now after all that jet lag. And now a word of Torah. This week we read a portion from the middle of the book of Numbers, Bamidbar. It's named after a man named Pinchas, whose story really began at the end of last week's portion of Balak. The situation is familiar. For the umpteenth time, the people of Israel have been disobeying the Torah and worshiping other gods. This time, the apostasy has reached epidemic proportion. Even the elite leadership of the people has begun to sample the religious wares of the Midianites and Moabites. Finally, one of the princes of the people challenges the authority of Moses. Publicly, he takes a sacred prostitute into his tent while the whole assembly watches. As Moses and the other elders stand by in shock, unable to respond to such chutzpah, a young Kohen, a priest named Pinchas, steps forward. He kills the wayward prince and his consort and breaks the spell of the false religious practice. For this act, he is rewarded by God, which seems to validate his violent vigilantism. But there is more to the story than meets the eye. Pinchas' reward for killing the couple is a brit shalom, an eternal covenant of peace. Neither he nor any of his descendants is ever again permitted to go to war or even carry a spear. He must minister to the needs of the tabernacle, the rituals of the altar, and the purification and sacrifice, and he can never engage in any more acts of violence. He has broken the Israelites' latest fascination with paganism, but never again will that level of religious violence be tolerated. It must instead be sublimated to serve the needs of the community. An ongoing lesson about the dangers of religious fanaticism. Judaism refuses to countenance the kind of religious insanity that led to the Crusades, or to the Jihad, or to the Inquisition, or to any kind of true religious terrorism. In spite of the occasional anomaly, our religious fervor is not designed ever to lead to violence. We are committed fervently and firmly to the same Brit Shalom, the covenant of peace that God placed on Pinchas. So, in this challenging time, may it prove to be, so may it always be. When we come back in a few moments here on Too Jewish, we'll hear from Molly Antipole about what it takes to write a remarkable new book about what it means to be un-American. Stay with us here on Too Jewish.
Safety. It's a word we take for granted at home and at the workplace, but sometimes safety isn't a sure thing. Environmental Strategies, Inc. is an environmental remediation company that's been promoting safe living in Arizona since 1989. Environmental Strategies specializes in asbestos and lead abatement, mold remediation, and industrial cleaning. In addition, they have a building and remodeling division that makes it convenient for clients to get all their services from one contractor. Environmental Strategies jobs range from seam tape removal in a single-family home to insulation removal in a Challenger Learjet aircraft and everything in between. So, if you're in need of asbestos or lead removal, mold remediation, industrial cleaning, or top-notch general contracting services, call Environmental Strategies today at 884-1114. Estimates and bids are free and confidential. Ken Goodman is the president, and he'd love to talk with you about your project. Environmental Strategies, serving all of Arizona since 1989. Call 884-1114.
I was 15 when I started my first business, and I never looked back. When it came time for college, I looked for a university that would foster my entrepreneurial spirit and that also had a sense of community. ASU's W.P. Carey School of Business ranks among the best in the nation, and the several Jewish organizations on campus make it easy for ASU to become a home away from home. At ASU, I'm upholding the traditions of my family while pursuing my dreams, and as CEO of Simple, I'm well on my way. I'm Arthur Steingart, and I'm a Sun Devil. ASU. Dream it. Do it. Visit asu.edu.
We continue with our Too Jewish update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
Funeral for Eyal Yifrach, Gilad Shar, and Naftali Frankel, kidnapped while hitchhiking home for Shabbat, murdered and their bodies hidden, was held early last week. It was a painful and powerful service. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu and President Shimon Peres eulogized the teens at the joint funeral, which was located near the boys' family homes in the Modin Cemetery. "Today has spontaneously become a national day of mourning," Netanyahu said. President Shimon Peres vowed, "We will strike with a strong hand until terror is eradicated at the root. Terrorism is a boomerang," saying that the acts of terror, such as the kidnapping, are directed at Israel, but do far more harm to those who carry out the acts. Three mothers who had prayed to be able to tuck their sons into bed again safely, instead bid them farewell, as the boys' bodies slipped into their final resting places and were covered with dirt in the Modin Cemetery. The bodies had been wrapped in blue and white Israeli flags. Prior to the funeral, hundreds of people participated in separate memorial services at the teens' respective homes in Eilad, Talmon, and Nof Ayalon. Speaking at the ceremony for Gilad Shar in Talmon, Finance Minister Yair Lapid said, "We aren't burying a settler. This isn't a loss for just one sector or another, but for all of Israel." He added, "I understand the desire for revenge, but we need now love, togetherness." Defense Minister Moshe Ya'alon attended the ceremony for Eyal Yifrach in Eilad. He said that the three boys were murdered just because they were Jewish. True enough. And at Naftali Frankel's ceremony near his Nof Ayalon home, his mother Rachel, who has become a hero in Israel through her fortitude and dignity in this terrible situation, thanked the police and the army. She said, "You promised you would find them, and you did. That is a great kindness." In more terrible news from Israel, a Palestinian teenager was abducted and murdered this week. 17-year-old Mohammed Abu Khader was forced into a car while he waited at a mosque to eat his pre-Ramadan fast meal and enter to pray. Israeli Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu issued a statement calling on all sides not to take the law into their own hands, adding that Israel's a nation of laws and everyone must act according to the law. Netanyahu, in a conversation with Public Security Minister Yitzhak Aharonovich, directed him to work as quickly as possible in order to investigate who is behind the reprehensible murder and what the motive was. Many around the world have already decided it was a reprisal murder by Jewish extremists. We will see. In other news related to the Israeli pressure on Hamas exerted in the effort to find the three teenagers, rocket fire from Gaza has escalated sharply this week, with Israel responding to each incident. Homes were damaged or destroyed in Sderot and even Ofakim in the south. No Israeli injuries have yet been reported. And in Oslo, Norway, the Norwegian Jewish community is seeking the dismissal of the Secretary General of the World B'nai Akiva movement after he called for the murder of three Israeli teens to be avenged with blood. Rabbi Noam Perel made the call in a Facebook post last Monday, hours after the bodies of the three Israeli teens were discovered in a field north of Hebron, 18 days after their kidnapping by people whom Israel says were terrorists belonging to Hamas. "The travesty will be atoned for with the enemy's blood, not with our tears," Perel wrote. "A whole nation and thousands of years of history demands revenge. The government of Israel is convened for a meeting of vengeance that is not a mourning sitting, not a shiva. Leaders have gone crazy at the sight of the bodies of our sons, a government that would make the army of searchers into an army of avengers." Yeesh. Perel later deleted the post and issued an apology. B'nai Akiva is a worldwide national religious youth group. In an open letter sent to the World Zionist Organization and the JNF officials and other leaders of Scandinavian Jewish communities, Irvin Cohn, president of the Jewish community in Oslo, demanded that Perel be dismissed. "While the killings invoke all kinds of feelings of rage in each and every one," Cohn wrote, "Perel's message goes against everything we believe in and the moral attitudes we try to instill in our children." And finally, the world's oldest man, a New York Jew who attempted to flee the Nazis' rise to power in Poland in 1939, has died at the age of 111. Alexander Imich held the title of the world's oldest validated man for just 2 months before he died last Sunday. While he was the world's oldest man, there are 66 women who are older than his 111 years. Wow. Imich was born in Częstochowa in southern Poland to a wealthy secular Jewish family. He said he was not allowed to join the Polish Navy because of anti-Semitism. He and his wife were sent from Białystok, Poland, where they fled after the Nazis rose to power, to a Soviet labor camp. When they came back to Poland after the war, they discovered that many family members had died in the Holocaust. They immigrated to Connecticut in 1951. Imich told a reporter that holding the world's record for being the oldest man is not like it's the Nobel Prize, and that "I never thought I'd be that old." Well, who does? He did say he never drank alcohol. He and his wife, who died in 1986, did not have children. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews around the world. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, author Molly Antipol. She has a wonderful collection of short stories, her first book called The Un-Americans. Broad reach of, we'll talk about the stories and you'll get a feel, but a very rich and interesting collection that ranges from the old world to Israel to America and a variety of ages and interesting people. Molly, when you began sort of crafting this, when did you decide this was a book?
It took a long time. I was, you know, the stories took me 10 years to write. And with each story, I was just trying to make it work on its own. And I actually had a fear. I think I was maybe halfway done with the stories. And I thought, oh, my gosh, like they're so different. You know, some of them take place in Israel and some of them, you know, years before, you know, sort of, in, as you said, in the old world, and some of them are contemporary. And I was about halfway done with my book when I realized, okay, they're not threaded together by character or by setting, but rather by a question that just kept popping up for me with every story. And the question was, you know, what happens when you dedicate yourself to a cause that loses relevance in the course of world events? And how does that affect the people that are closest to you? And once I realized that I was working with a question, then I was able to finish the book with that in mind.
You know, I remember when Nathan Englander's incredible collection of short stories came out, and everybody said, "Okay, so what's next?" Did people ask you that?
every day.
How does that feel? I mean, here you've shepherded this collection. It took you 10 years. You've got a great book out, and now everybody says, okay, so what's next?
It's so true. Well, what I will say is that I hope the next one won't take me 10 years, because now I've, you know, with that first book, I was learning how to write. And actually, Nathan Englander, he was my teacher in graduate school, and he read some of these earliest stories. And we would talk about that a lot, because, you know, his novel after For the Relief from Unbearable Urges, I think it was 10 years later. Like, it just takes a long time.
Yeah. Yeah, I would think so. And everybody was upset that
I have a novel under contract with the same publisher, so I'm working away on that. And I'm actually finding that to be pretty enjoyable, I think, because with my stories, they took so long because they all required a lot of research and sort of imagining worlds. And so it's nice to kind of stay in one world with the same group of people.
In writing, do you find that you're using your own life experience all the time, part of the time? How much of this comes from you?
You know, it's funny. I don't have any stories in the book about, you know, a woman in her 30s, you know, living in San Francisco and teaching creative writing. Like, those stories would be very hard for me to write. But I do feel that all of these stories are very autobiographical in the sense that they have captured what I questioned and obsessed over during the time that I was writing them. And I think that without even realizing it, I was, you know, really interested in these ideas of legacies and of, you know, sort of time for art versus time for family, and all these questions that I just had for myself as I came of age, really just kept coming up in the book.
These are serious stories. They're real people. They seem to kind of come right off the page. They're people you might have known. Do you ever write stories just for fun?
I wish I could say yes, because then my days might be more fun. but no, I think once I invest in a story and invest in characters, I just end up going to some kind of bad places always. I do other things for fun, but yeah, writing for me, it feels like something else.
I did have somebody say, you know, there are no great novels with happy endings. It doesn't work like that.
I know. I think about that a lot. I would like so much to write one. I've gotten emails or letters from people saying that they thought the end of The Quietest Man was a happy ending, which is funny because I thought of it as an incredibly dark ending.
It's pretty dark.
You know, when this father is lying to his daughter, but some people found it to be uplifting. So that was great.
How long does it, this is a, you took you 10 years to put this together, but what's the quickest you've ever written a story?
With a couple of these stories, I got drafts out pretty quickly. Like, I had a draft out in, you know, I don't know, 2 or 3 months. But when it comes that quickly to me, it's almost like I don't trust it. And so then I put it in a drawer for a while, and then just start, when I take it out of the drawer, I just start to really, really work on it kind of sentence by sentence for a long time. So yeah, I don't think any of these stories took less than 10 drafts.
Did anybody tell you that your stories or your book was too Jewish?
No, that's funny.
Because it's pretty Jewish.
I think my publisher was pretty happy about it, actually.
Maybe we've passed the day when a book could be too Jewish and they didn't want to publish it.
Right. Oh, that's really interesting. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I think I haven't gotten that. But it's also funny because in some ways, you know, I grew up in a very, you know, kind of secular and very lefty household. But my in-laws are a lot more religious than my parents. And, you know, my father-in-law's a rabbi. And so it was interesting for me to, during the time that I was writing this book, to, you know, to join another family that is much more religious than my upbringing and think about. And so it really made me think about the way that I might be portraying, conservative and Orthodox Judaism, because I had grown up in such a secular reform household.
Let's talk about the experience of growing up in a, you know, as you said, a left-wing household. Were people in your family actually blacklisted?
Yeah, well, they weren't involved in the Hollywood stuff. But my grandfather was a union organizer, and he was just consistently fired from jobs and was in jail, and was just under a tremendous amount of surveillance. And I think that with the early stories, it really was me trying to understand, especially what that might have been like for my mom and for her siblings, because they just inherited all of those politics. Those weren't their choices, and yet everything, their entire lifestyles and their entire lives were completely influenced by it.
What writers influenced you in becoming a writer and writing the way you write?
See, I love Grace Paley. She's probably my favorite writer, and I can feel I mean, there's no way that she didn't influence me because I've read her book so many times.
You know, I hadn't thought about that.
James Baldwin, I really love.
I hadn't thought about that, but there is some Grace Paley in here. I can see that.
Oh, thank you. That's nice to hear. I love Alice Munro. I love her stories. I think Edith Perlman is just terrific.
Do you?
I could go.
You could probably go on. Who do you like?
Oh, yeah, I could go on and on and on. I love Deborah Eisenberg. Edward P. Jones, I think, is really terrific. I just read The Good Lord Bird, James McBride's novel, that I thought was just absolutely fantastic and riveting. I love Meg Wolitzer.
How do you teach writing?
It's tricky because it really depends on the students more than anything else. What I've found is that I can't make someone who's not a natural writer become a natural writer. And if a student is already an incredibly talented writer, I'm not going to teach them how to be more talented. But what I can do is teach them how to become good readers. And that's really the way that I see it. I think that if I can get each student really excited about books and turn them on to writers that they might not have known, and they can kind of look to them for inspiration, then I've done my job.
Tell me where the title came from, The Un-Americans.
The title was an interesting process. It was, you know, obviously a word that had a strong connotation growing up, you know, because my grandparents had, you know, been called un-American.
Right.
And so it fit very well with my McCarthy era stories. But as I was writing, I kept thinking about what that word might mean in a very literal sense to my Israeli characters. All of my Israel stories are contemporary. And I kept thinking about what this, about this very, very close and almost symbiotic relationship that, that you know, Israelis have to America, and especially with this current generation of Israelis, you know, who have basically inherited this really close relationship. And my husband and I spend a few months of the year every year in Israel, and I see it so much with my Israeli friends, just the way that they're so engaged in American politics. And there's a way that you almost can't be. And so I thought a lot about that with the word. And then with the Eastern Europe stories, what was so interesting to me was this idea, you know, for so many of them, they're, you know, banned artists or dissident writers, or, you know, involved in politics in some way. And they really risked their lives for their politics in their mother countries, only to come to the U.S. where they're treated as anything but American. You know, where for a lot of them, they've lived under so much surveillance, and suddenly they realize, wait, I'm not here in the U.S. I'm not even really being watched. I'm just not even being noticed. And so I was interested in it, and for all of these different things. And I kind of liked the idea that the title, one, wasn't related to a specific story, and two, might not click for the reader right away. I liked the idea that it might happen maybe like halfway into the book, that it would really, really click for the reader what it meant to them.
I want to thank Molly Antipo for a great visit. I agree. I thought at first, you know, House Un-American Activities Committee, and then I realized how much more broadly it addressed the whole issue of being American and coming to America and people who weren't American. Molly, it's a great book called The Un-Americans. I strongly advise everybody to read it, and I look forward to following your work and continuing to talk.
Oh, well, thank you so much. This was so much fun. I really appreciate you having me on the show and also for reading my book. I really appreciate it.
It's a great pleasure. When we come back on Too Jewish, we'll hear about next week's guest get a final musical playout.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reformed, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday at 9 o'clock. Our guest will be world political analyst Professor Jonathan Edelman, an expert on Russia, China, and the Middle East, getting us caught up on some of the many changes going on in this unstable world in the summer of 2014. Our playout this morning comes from Morada de Corazon. It's a CD from Spain by Eduardo Paniagua and Jorge Rosenblum. It's called Descansal a Shabbat, a song for the Sabbath using the Yemenite Dror Yikra melody, but played in an Andalusian Spanish manner. Really lovely. My friends, may you be blessed with a Shavua Tov, a good week, and a week, we pray, of peace.